That's McCoy Tyner and the Latin All-Stars with Afro Blue, composed by the great Afro-Cuban percussionist Mongo Santa Maria and considered a jazz classic. It's from his album, McCoy Tyner and the Latin All-Stars, released in 1998 with, of course, McCoy on piano, Gary Bartz on saxophone, Claudio Roditi on trumpet and flugelhorn, Steve Ture, one of my favorites, on trombone, Dave Valentine, another one, on flute, Avery Sharp on bass, Ignacio Berroa on drums, Johnny Almendra on timbales, and Giovanni Hidalgo on percussion. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Wednesday. Unbelievably, it is the 1st of July, 2015, and a lot to talk about today. We're finishing up and just building on the discussion that we started some weeks ago on where we are and the reality that we are living in, but such effort is being made to persuade us that what we know to be real actually is not. And today we hear from federal authorities, or at least it's being reported that federal authorities probing a fire that destroyed Mount Zion African Methodist Episcopal Church in Greeleyville, South Carolina, last night, reportedly have come to the conclusion that arson was not the cause. The church, you may recall, was burned down 20 years ago by Klansmen, and Mount Zion's razing, it's the seventh black church in the South to be destroyed by fire in recent weeks, naturally has revived in the minds of many in the South a history of white supremacist terrorism against African Americans and things and people they hold dear. We will get to this discussion today about the significance of the black church, the symbolism of it, and why there are so many attacks that have been documented against black churches, and not just in the South. We know that this has been a long documented history. And it is interesting that we see South Carolina cropping up over and over again as a kind of epicenter of our discussion. South Carolina was where Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church was founded by people who had been enslaved, some who were able to purchase their freedom, and some like Denmark Vesey, one of the founders of this church, who was able to purchase his freedom but could not purchase the freedom of his wife and children, and who became affiliated with this church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and the word African is very, very important to understand. They were very clear about what they had in common was a culture and a history and a shared situation of oppression in this country by virtue of their culture and history. And, of course, America has come to regard this as the invented thing of race. They were of the, quote, inferior race, unquote. And even here in Charleston, South Carolina, we see even within the religious community, because the Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church also had been practitioners of white supremacy, forbidding Africans to be part of their congregation. So there was a fight by itself to liberate themselves in order to just maintain some kind of a point of spirituality. And that was a fight too, because white supremacy was just so pervasive. The people who settled in this land came with it. Their institutions educated them to operate this way. This is how you're supposed to operate. You have complete permission to do whatever you will and whatever you wish in this so-called new world that you're traveling to, because whoever you meet is inferior to you. Whoever you meet is there to do your bidding. They're not people. They, in fact, in one instance in England at the time, at the height of the slave trade, we had great high-profile people making the case that Africans, there was no reason to feel badly about capturing people and taking them wherever you wanted to drop them off and laying claim to them the way you would, you know, you own furniture or you own a horse, that they were in fact put on earth to be slaves. They did not have souls. And that actually was a very telling line in, of all movies, The Godfather, when there was this meeting called by the mafia lords at that time, and the question was whether to go into the drug business big time. And one of the dons offered an analysis. He said, there should be no problem. It shouldn't be in our communities. And that's the main thing. It should not be in our communities. But it is okay to propagate and to penetrate the black communities with drugs, to saturate them with drugs, because, he said, they have no souls. A relatively modern-day interpretation of a very old, old belief perpetuated nonetheless by the Catholic Church. Everybody was in it. Everybody was in it. So Charleston, South Carolina, was a major staging point. I mentioned, of course, that at one point, Charleston, South Carolina, was actually a majority slave state. And so when the likes of Denmark Vesey and others came along and said, we should not accept this, and they founded institutions, they fashioned a way of creating a system. It was not perfect at all, but by the time that Denmark Vesey began to talk about the need to overthrow the system of slavery, to discuss it in the sense of the right of people to be free. Many people who came here as enslaved persons were in fact from very noble families in the African countries they came from. And it was significant that he would organize it in Charleston, impressed by the efforts already made by slaves in Haiti, particularly where he also had lived. And this church, since that time, in fact, the year of this so-called rising, as it was called, that was the plan to stage a major slave revolt, was in 1822. And it was also the year that Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church was burned to the ground. 1822. Coming forward into the 20th century, we have a long list, a very long list of churches that have been bombed, dynamited, burned, and in other ways destroyed, principally with white supremacy serving as the political, social, cultural, economic rationale for such actions. Bethel Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, bombed in 1956. Allen Temple African Methodist Episcopal Church in Bessemer, Alabama, dynamited 1957. Bethel Baptist Church again in 1958, the following year, bombed again. 1962, New Bethel Baptist Church, St. Luke's African Methodist Episcopal Church, Triumph Church and Kingdom of God, and Christ Church, all in Birmingham, Alabama, bombed 1962. St. Matthew's Baptist Church in Macon, Georgia, burned to the ground. The fifth church burned that month. Bethel Baptist Church again in Alabama, a third bomb, third time, blows out the church's windows. James United Methodist Church in Birmingham, 1963, destroyed by a gasoline bomb. We know of 1963 because that was the year on September the 15th that the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham was bombed. 22 people were injured, but we know of the four little girls who were killed. Mount Zion Methodist Church in Longdale, Mississippi, burned to the ground, 1964. And we know this because this was the precedent to the killing of Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney, the civil rights workers who were trying to enlist blacks to vote. The list goes on and on. We wouldn't have time for me to recite it, the entire list. But the church, the black church, is a symbol. This church, Mount Zion African Methodist Episcopal Church, we are about to hear, 20 years ago, when in fact it was razed to the ground by Klansmen in Greeleyville, South Carolina. Here is the president at the time addressing the nation and certainly addressing the community. This is Bill Clinton in 1995.
Happened 90 years ago when the other church was built. People might have expected things like a church bombing. That was the time of Jim Crow, and there were even lynchings in the South. It was a time of abject poverty, worse than anything we call poverty today. It was, 90 years ago, an expression of faith and courage for people to get together and build a church. But it was the church that saved the people, until the Civil Rights Revolution came along. And it is, therefore, I think, doubly troubling to people, some of whom are over here on this platform today, who spent their entire lives working for equal opportunity among our people, working for an end to the hatred that divided us for too long, to see our native South engulfed in a rash of church burnings over the last year and a half. We have to say to all of you who've been afflicted by this, We know that we're not going back to those dark days, but we are now reminded that our job is not done. Dr. King once said, "What self-centered men have torn down, other-centered men can build up." The men and women of Mount Zion have shown us the meaning of these words by refusing to be defeated and by building up this new church. Others have come together with you. The pastor told me he got contributions from all over the world to help to rebuild this church. In just a few days, we'll have a joyful noise coming out of this church. But today, just as you have come together, I want to ask the people of America to come together. I want to ask every citizen, as we stand on this hallowed ground together, to help to rebuild our churches, to restore hope, to show the forces of hatred they cannot win. I want to ask every citizen in America to say, we are not going back, we are not slipping back to those dark days. Every time you hear somebody use race or religion as an instrument of division and hatred, speak up against it. Every time you hear somebody do that. If you have any inclination, any evidence of anything you have seen or heard that somebody else might be planning to do something like this, tell the local authorities and let's stop this before it gets started. If you know anything about any of the unsolved cases, come help us solve them. This is wrong. The American people are the most religious, church-going people of any great democracy. We cannot let someone come into our democratic home, the home of our faith, and start torching our houses of worship. It doesn't matter whether it's this Christian church or the mosque that was burned in South Carolina. People have a right to worship God any way they please. That's what the First Amendment of the Constitution is about. We cannot ever let this happen in our country again.
Yes, I had my little microphone on mute for a minute. Well, that was Bill Clinton speaking in 1995, 3 years after he took the time when he was running for president to himself demonstrate his commitment to racial equality by executing Ricky Ray Rector, to just make the point about how tough he is on crime. Ricky Ray Rector was, even by the court, said to be a disabled man, mentally disabled. He had tried to kill himself and literally blew part of his brain away and shot himself in the head as a way of trying to get out of going to jail. But the then governor, Bill Clinton, made it a point to take time from his campaign to go back to Arkansas to sign Ricky Ray Rector's execution. But he makes an interesting point just the same, and not that, you know, you would think so, but the point that he is making is a point that you should be taking away from this discussion, and that is he's talking in 1995 about what happened 90 years ago when the church was burned. And here we are in 2015, and we're having the same conversation. And it is he talks about the forces of hatred. He wouldn't say they were white forces of hatred, because we're real clear about who was doing the church burnings and who's doing them now. He's not mentioning that. But he comes to talk to people who know very well, because they are on the receiving end of this violence, as he would prefer to call it. The dark days of yesteryear. The dark days of yesteryear. In 1995, Bill Clinton officially pronounced that it was a new day. After all, he quoted Martin Luther King to let you know that it's a whole new day. The Civil Rights Revolution, he talked about in the 60s. Well, that's where he chose to date a struggle that had begun at least two centuries before. So the reality is distorted all the way around. But people were just grateful that the then president of the United States, having shown white America his resolve to keep black Americans in check, shows up to play the role of the benevolent president. Not at all saying what his administration would do, but again, in classic fashion, and we've discussed this, it relates to Hillary Clinton. We'll get to her in the second half of the program. And he's talking also to the people. This is your job. If you see something, say something. Help us fix it. But, you know, primarily, this is your responsibility. We heard it from him. We heard it from Barack Obama. All to show you that the common theme here is, one, a recognition that this is a totally white supremacist problem. It is pervasive in the United States. Here is one aspect of it expressing itself in the bombings and murders and assassinations of people in their churches. That's a documented history going back to 1822. And we're hearing the same nonsense today about what we all have to do as a society, and America is the most religious society. Well, you know, does this in any way give credence to that? That it is a God-fearing society. People have to come together, says Clinton, in the same way that Barack Obama would later say just last week at that funeral. He says, we have to work together to defeat the forces of hatred, super simplifying what we know is the problem. This is a structural problem, a systemic problem, and a long-standing historical fact that no administration effectively has tackled, nor wishes to tackle. They'll make speeches. They'll talk about it. But only to the extent that it allows them the opportunity to go broad. We're all in this together. No. The documented facts suggest that we're not all in this together. We never have been. And the reason they attack these churches is, of course, symbolically, it is the gathering place. It's a kind of nerve center of black communities. And it is meant to remind African Americans, we have you in check. We could even come directly into your places of worship where you think you have some kind of cushion against the vagaries of the world. And we could destroy you in your church as well. I remind you that even in the face of an assassination, a black president is not willing to concede at all that it in fact was an assassination, the killing of not just Reverend Clementa Pinckney, but eight other people who were assassinated at church. Even that cannot come out of Barack Obama's mouth and never will. Which brings me to the role of the church. I have repeatedly referenced Denmark Vesey and this church as not a place to placate people, but to connect them with their reality and their power to change things. That was the purpose of the Black Church, and it was a uniform purpose. Very much so, to tend to the wounded souls and to give them the courage to proceed with life in the face of awesome obstacles against them. But also to validate their desire to be free, to validate their rights. That was the role of the church, to advocate and agitate and to validate struggle, to validate it. To say you have as much right as anybody else, if not even more so, because you built this country. You have a right. And the so-called Constitution that Bill Clinton just quoted, you know, is the right of the First Amendment. He's talking about First Amendment rights as if any constitutional amendment has ever just completely applied. You have amendments, and then you have to have constitutional amendments to amend the First Amendments that were given very grudgingly. Do Black people have First Amendment rights, really, in the United States? You really believe that? That was the role of the church. But today, we see the church as a palliative, the church as a partner with the system, by and large. The church as a pacifier. The church being used as an instrument of oppression of their own people. The church as an extension of one party or the other. The church led by crazed individuals in some cases, expecting a $65 million personal aircraft from their congregations so that they can spread the word of God in style, of course. And with prayer, hopefully it would happen. You would give up your rent money so that I could have a jet. The church today, in many cases, is so far afield of the concepts and the precepts that drove it during the days of struggle, and even the recent days of struggle. Its leadership has been co-opted, and in some cases, volunteered for co-optation. And this is why I say we have to get real, even about your church. Even about your church. I'll take this break and come back and talk about Sister Hillary appears to be having some problems right after this. You're listening to PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lee. This is Lead Stories. I'm going to read you a story filed by Reuters reporters Jonathan Allen and Alistair Bell today. And it is instructive about the role of media, again, in shaping or misshaping our reality. It's titled, the headline says, Clinton struggled to fit in with Obama's White House, emails show. All right. Here's the story. Hillary Clinton struggled to fit into the government of President Barack Obama after being appointed Secretary of State in 2009, according to emails released by the State Department on Tuesday. They showed Clinton turning up for meetings that had been canceled and worrying about how much time she had with her new boss, revealing growing pains in the relationship between her and former election rival Obama in the early months of her time as America's top diplomat. In an email to two aides on June the 8th, 2009, Clinton was unsure if the White House had held a cabinet meeting and whether she should attend. Quote, I heard on the radio that there is a cabinet meeting this AM. Is there? Can I go? If not, who are we sending? Unquote, Clinton wrote. A State Department official wrote back that the government was holding a meeting, but not a full cabinet meeting that she needed to be at. As Clinton sought to navigate her relationship with the Obama White House, she corresponded with several former aides and advisors to her husband, former President Bill Clinton. They included Sidney Blumenthal, a former White House speechwriter, Sandy Berger, the former National Security Advisor, and Mark Penn, who served as a political advisor to both Bill Clinton and to Hillary Clinton's 2008 White House bid. As the Obama administration was conducting a review of its policy in Afghanistan, for example, Penn emailed her and advised her not to ignore the threat posed by the Taliban. While they were fierce competitors on the campaign trail, Clinton and Obama eventually struck up a cordial working relationship in the 4 years she spent as Secretary of State. As she runs for the White House again at the November 2016 election, Clinton's relationship with her fellow Democrat will come under further scrutiny. While she has aligned herself with the Obama administration on issues that are popular with the base of Democratic supporters, such as immigration reform, she has also tried to make her own mark by distancing herself from Obama on trade. Back in 2009, there were few misunderstandings, according to an email Clinton sent, about what she thought was a meeting at the White House. Quote, I arrived for the 10:15 meeting and was told there was no meeting, unquote, she wrote to aides. This is the second time this has happened. What's up? She asked. The emails released on Tuesday are among some 30,000 work emails relating to Clinton that a judge has ordered to be released in batches after a controversy broke out earlier this year when she acknowledged using a personal email account rather than a government one for State Department business. As she began her tenure, Clinton worried about perceptions that she was not meeting enough with the president, given that former President Richard Nixon used to see his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, daily. Quote, in thinking about the Kissinger interview, the only issue I think that might be raised is that I see POTUS, that is the President of the United States, at least once a week, while Kay, meaning Kissinger, saw Nixon every day, she said in an email to a spokesman using Washington shorthand for President of the United States. Do you see this as a problem, she asked spokesman Philippe Raines. It goes on. The rest of the title of the article is not necessarily relevant to where I'm going with this discussion today, because enough has been established in this article to suggest that the problem was Hillary Clinton just trying to fit in. It communicates, here's a woman, you know, and all the things that go with that, that she was a woman and she'd hit the glass ceiling even within the cabinet. She was essentially locked out by mean old Obama. See how it works? And of course, they took the time to mention she's distancing herself from Barack Obama on the matter of trade, the Trans-Pacific Partnership specifically. It doesn't say how she got to be Secretary of State at all. And that's, I think that's a good part of the story. What accounts for this alienation? Might it have been how she got to be Secretary of State? Might it have been her conduct against Barack Obama when they both were candidates, presidential candidates, and what she said, the awful thing she said, that she is surrounded by people that even Rahm Emanuel, the former chief of staff, found offensive. And Sidney Blumenthal is on the top of his list. He, in fact, said he is not to be hired, and Hillary Clinton wanted to hire him. So here's a story that gives you the impression of Hillary Clinton being a victim here. She is being kind of sidelined by Obama, except we know that she got the job because that was part of the political deal that Obama cut. All right, we give Hillary whatever she wants because it was already set even back then that Hillary will be a candidate for president at some point when Barack's term is over. And that she was to be accepted. She was bulldozed and placed as Secretary of State. That's how she got the job. She wasn't qualified for it. Still isn't to this day. No qualifications other than the fact that she was married to a man who was the President of the United States. And that automatically qualified her. And that was the deal. It is very clear. Nobody trusted Hillary Clinton because, like Bill, she was not to be trusted, plain and simple. She had already done enough damage during the presidential race, and it remains mysterious to many why Barack Obama would actually appoint somebody like this, this viper. Why would he appoint somebody like that to such a prominent job? And that is what I mean about this business. Here's white supremacy working again. The woman wasn't even qualified because she was fired from her first job as an intern in Congress when she did some shady stuff with records pertaining to the impeachment of Richard Nixon. She hid. She actually hid records that would have impacted negatively on the whole impeachment process. And she was just an intern. She wasn't even central to this question. She was just working on a committee. And the guy who was running it fired her for ethical problems and for lying. She suddenly couldn't find some records and had no idea where they went. The same thing, the same pattern. We've seen this with Hillary Clinton over and over again. Records in the Whitewater scandal, we don't know where the records are. The travel bureau scandal, where records pertaining to how the costs of travel were charged, no records. We have no records. We don't know where they are. And recently, even here, with the emails, where are the emails? Even the State Department says emails are missing. We don't know. That's her response. So Hillary Clinton is a known liar. And she and her husband, I've described them as the Bonnie and Clyde of politics. They just mow everybody down to get where they want. And they'd succeeded with Barack Obama. We talked about that on this program. She bulldozed her way into the U.S. Senate, and the Democratic Party allowed it because that was the gift that they had given her for not leaving Bill and not causing a major, major embarrassment to him during his problems and his peccadilloes. She behaved perfectly as the compliant, submissive wife, and her reward was a U.S. Senate seat. Absolutely. And then her reward, again, pushed farther and further up, her reward was Secretary of State. And you compare Hillary Clinton's credentials with any Secretary of State's credentials, and you tell me this woman was qualified. But she's a white woman in America with an agenda and armed with a narrative that completely just overhauls the reality. She's a vile human being, but absolutely dedicated to her own survival. Because it is linked with all that money that they're making and all the powers and power and connections that will help her and her husband and now her daughter make a lot of money. But here she's presented as a kind of, oh, they're dumping on Hillary. They treated her so badly. They treated her that way because she is not to be trusted. She is not to be trusted. And what did we see? Just the other day, she threw Barack Obama right under the bus. Just as she left, she did her farewell tour. I'd never heard of a public official doing a farewell tour, let alone somebody who is Secretary of State. All these trips that she made abroad that were still nobody is questioning whether they were necessary or not, but she had a use of the best services, a plane, pilots, limousines, security. She had the best hotels and the best food and everything. So, and it was all on the taxpayers. So she was flying all over the place. And, of course, we are to understand this was all on government business, had nothing to do with the Clinton Initiative or the Clinton Foundation, as it's now called. The Bill, Hillary, and what's the daughter's name? Clinton, Chelsea Clinton Foundation. Every story about Hillary Clinton suggests she is the worst possible candidate that anybody could have encountered. And the worst possible example of the kind of women who ought to be in public life. The worst kind. But the media, being part of the whole process, is now sanitizing, reporting that it was the Obama administration that gave her a hard time, that made it a struggle for her to fit in. No, they should have also reported why. Why was it that the Obama administration wanted nothing to do with Hillary Clinton or the people who came with her? Nobody wants them. Nobody who knows them wants them close. And it was clear that from the very beginning, this was a concession Obama was forced to make or felt he was forced to make because he made a pact with the devil, and the devil were the Clintons. The devil was the Clintons, correctly. That's the deal. So he set in motion this end, this piece of the puzzle. He set it in motion by conceding to her appointment as Secretary of State, somebody completely unqualified for the job. But here, too, this is the dynamic that exists. Condoleezza Rice, whether you like her or you don't like her, you know her or you don't know her, whatever you want to think about her or Madeleine Albright or Jean Kirkpatrick, the fact is these women invested the appropriate amount of energy and education to prepare themselves for public life. They studied. They spoke several languages. They've written books. of note, not about of self, but of note, about world events. Now, whether you agree with their politics or not, I'm saying that they walked in the door with huge credits to them that suggest that they prepared themselves and they were academically and professionally and experientially qualified for that job. Colin Powell had to be, you know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to be Secretary of State. What's Hillary Clinton's qualification? What are her, what papers is she walking in the door with to say, I'm ready to essentially deal with this job credibly because I have the credentials. You're a lawyer. So what? If I put a bullhorn out of the window and said, calling all lawyers, I'll have a stampede in half an hour. Everybody and their grandpappy is a lawyer these days. And she was not a very good lawyer either. And there were questions about her lawyering, ethical questions. So on no level was this woman walking in the door, squeaky clean, and to be accepted as a person who is right for any job. But look what we have. Hillary Clinton is leading the pack. She's going to buy her way into the presidency. She intends to raise $2.5 billion. She just finished raising $45 million in the first quarter of her candidacy. And that is what people need to understand. The reality is you could conjure up any kind of reality you want when you have the money. And here the media are doing the job of cleansing the uncleansable, if I could invent that word. Hillary Clinton being the target. She was just so, she struggled so hard to fit in. They didn't want her. They didn't want her to do her job. She had such a hard time as a woman. She hit, even Barack Obama, the liberal Barack Obama, had installed a glass ceiling. That's the story I want you to, I tell you. You know, if you really don't have your brain working, you would be a very, very, very confused person. And you would take all these things that they have designed for you to think. You would take it all in, and that would be what you're operating on. So today, I hope we touched on both Clintons, as a matter of fact. It just occurred to me. We had Bill Clinton telling the old familiar story, a distortion of reality in the South. And here we have Sister Hillary presenting an entirely different picture from what we know really happened. Her job, she did not get it fairly. She didn't compete with anybody. She did not have to climb the way most people get through their political careers. You get elected to dog catcher, and then you go up to cat catcher and whatever before you begin to deal with the electoral process. Oh, no. She walked out of the White House. In fact, she left the White House 2 years before Bill did because she could not deal with the embarrassment that he caused her. But she collected and still is collecting, just like any other enterprising woman. See? Fairness has nothing to do with it. Equal opportunity has nothing to do with that. Affirmative action, now that's Hillary Clinton is an example of what is meant by affirmative action in this country. Thank you for joining me today. Thank you for your notes. I've been receiving incredible response to the series that we've been doing. Thank you for that. And I'm so glad that we are able to have this outlet to connect with each other. Very shortly, we'll be having our phone lines up and running, and we'll catch up on lost time. But I want to thank you so much for being with me today. Keep it right here on PRN.FM and tell your friends about the station. Tell them that it, for you, is a necessary reference point every single day, and help me grow Lead Stories on PRN.FM. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Thanks so much. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.